Chapter 43. The journey from Detroit to Chicago in the month of June 1851 was not so pleasant as it is today. On the 15th of June, I first landed with the greatest difficulty on a badly wrecked wharf at the mouth of the river. Some of the streets I had to cross in order to reach the bishop's palace were almost impassable. In many places, loose planks had been thrown across them to prevent people from sinking in the mud and quicksands. The first sight of Chicago was then far from giving an idea of what that city has become in 1884. When I entered the miserable house called the Bishop's Palace, I could hardly believe my eyes. The planks of the lower floor in the dining room were floating, and it required a great deal of ingenuity to keep my feet dry while dining with him for the first time. But the Christian kindness and courtesy of the bishop made me more happy in his poor house than I felt later in the white marble palace built by his haughty successor, C. Reagan. There were then in Chicago about 200 French Canadian families under the pastorate of the Reverend M. A. LaBelle, who, like myself, was born in Kamouraska. The drunkenness and other immoralities of the clergy, pictured to me by that priest, surpassed all I had ever heard or known. After getting my promise that I would never reveal the fact before his death, he assured me that the last bishop had been poisoned by one of his grand vicars. He said the grand vicar, being father confessor of the nuns of Loreto, had fallen in love with one of the so-called virgins, who died a few days after becoming the mother of a stillborn child. This threatened a great scandal, so the bishop thought it was his duty to make an inquest and punish his priest if he should be found guilty. But the grand vicar found that the shortest way to escape exposure was to put an end to the inquest by murdering the bishop. A poison very difficult to detect was administered, and the death of the prelate soon followed, without exciting any surprise in the community. Horrified by this mystery of iniquity, I came very near returning to Canada immediately. But after more mature consideration, it seemed to me that these awful iniquities on the part of the priest of Illinois was just the reason why I should not shut my ears to the voice of God, if it were His will that I should come to take care of that of the precious souls He would trust to me. I spent a week in Chicago lecturing on temperance every evening and listening during the days to the grand plans of the bishop. The bishop was maturing to make our Church of Rome the mistress and ruler of the magnificent valley of the Mississippi. He clearly demonstrated to me that once mistress of the incalculable treasures of those rich lands, through the millions of her obedient children, our Church would easily command the respect and submission of the less favored states of the East. I felt really happy and thankful to God that He should have chosen me to help the Pope and the bishops realize such a noble and magnificent project. Leaving Chicago, it took me nearly 3 days to cross the vast prairies, which were then a perfect wilderness between Chicago and Bourbonnais. I spent 3 weeks in preaching and exploring the country, extending from the Kankakee River to the southwest towards the Mississippi. Only then did I plainly understand the greatness of the plans of the bishop. I determined to sacrifice the exalted position God had given me in Canada to guide the steps of the Roman Catholic immigrants from France, Belgium, and Canada towards the regions of the West in order to extend the power and influence of my church all over the United States. On my return to Chicago in the second week of July, all was arranged with the bishop for my coming back in the autumn. However, it was understood between us that my leaving Canada for the United States would be kept a secret till the last hour on account of the stern opposition I expected from my bishop. The last thing to be done on my return to Canada, in order to prepare the immigrants to go to Illinois rather than any other part of the United States, was to tell them through the press the unrivaled advantages which God had prepared for them in the West. I did so by writing a letter which was published not only by the press of Canada, but also in many papers of France and Belgium. I would never have published this letter if I had foreseen its effects on the farmers of Canada. In a few days after its appearance, their farms fell to half their value. In some parishes, everyone wanted to sell their lands and emigrate to the West. It was only for want of purchasers that we did not see an emigration which would have surely ruined Canada. I was frightened by its immediate effect on the public mind. However, while some were praising me to the skies for having published it, others were cursing me and calling me a traitor. The very day after its publication, I was in Quebec. The first one I met was my Lord de Charbonnet, Bishop of Toronto. After having blessed me, he pressed my hand in his and said, "I have just read your admirable letter. It is one of the most beautiful and eloquently written articles I ever read. The Spirit of God has surely inspired every one of its sentences. I have just now forwarded 6 copies of it to different journals in France and Belgium, where they will be republished and do an incalculable amount of good by directing the French-speaking Catholics immigrants towards a country where they will run no risk of losing their faith, with the assurance of securing a future of unbounded prosperity for their families. Your name will be put among the names of the greatest benefactors of humanity." Though these compliments seem to me much exaggerated and unmerited, I cannot deny that they pleased me. By adding to my hopes and convictions that great good would surely come from the plan, I thanked the bishop for his kind and friendly words and left him to go and present my respectful salutations to Bishop Bourget of Montreal and give him a short sketch of my voyage to the far west. I found him alone in his room, in the very act of reading my letter. A lioness who had just lost her whelps would not have looked upon me with more angry and threatening eyes. "Is it possible, Mr. Chiniki," he said, "that your hand has written and signed such a perfidious document? How could you so cruelly pierce the bosom of your own country after her dealing so nobly with you? Do you not see that your treasonable letters will give such an impetus to emigration that our most thriving parishes will soon be turned into solitude?" Surprised by this unexpected burst of bad feelings, I answered, Your lordship has surely misunderstood me. If you have found in my letter any treasonable plan to ruin our country, please read it again, and you will see that every line has been inspired by the purest motives of patriotism and the highest views of religion. The abrupt answer of the bishop gave clearly indicated that my absence would be more welcome than my presence. I left him after asking his blessing, which he gave me in the coldest manner possible. On the 25th of August, I was back at Longueuil from my voyage to Quebec, which I had extended as far as Kamouraska, to see again the noble-hearted parishioners whose unanimity in taking the Pledge of Temperance and admirable fidelity in keeping it then had filled my heart with such joy. I related my last interview with Bishop Berger to my faithful friend Mr. Brassard. He answered me, "The present bad feelings of the Bishop of Montreal against you are not a secret to me. Unfortunately, the low-minded men who surround and counsel him are as unable as the bishop himself to understand your exalted views in directing the steps of the Roman Catholics toward the splendid valley of the Mississippi. Now, I am sure of what I say, though I am not free to tell you how it came to my knowledge. There is a plot somewhere to dishonor and destroy you at once. Those who are at the head of that plot hope that if they can succeed in destroying your popularity, nobody will be tempted to follow you to Illinois. For though you have concealed it as well as you could, it is evident to everyone now that you are the man elected by the bishops of the West to direct the uncertain steps of the poor immigrants towards those rich lands." "Do you mean, my dear Mr. Brassard," I replied, "that there are priests around the Bishop of Montreal cruel and vile enough to forge calumnies against me and spread them before the country in such a way that I shall be unable to refute them?" "It is just what I mean," answered Mr. Brassard. "Mind what I tell you. The bishop has made use of you to reform his diocese. He likes you for that work. But your popularity is too great today for your enemies. They want to get rid of you, and no means will be too vile or criminal to accomplish your destruction if they can attain their object." "But, my dear Mr. Brassard, can you give me any details of the plots which are in store against me?" I asked. "No, I cannot, for I know them not. But be on your guard, for your few but powerful enemies are jubilant. They speak of the absolute impotency to which you will soon be reduced if you accomplish what they so maliciously and falsely call your treacherous objects." I answered, "Our Savior has said to all his disciples, 'In the world you shall have tribulation, but be of good cheer, I have overcome the world.' I am more determined than ever to put my trust in God and to fear no man." 2 hours after this conversation, I received the following from the Reverend Mr. Parr, secretary to the bishop. "To the Reverend Mr. Tinicky, Apostle of Temperance. My dear sir, my Lord Bishop of Montreal, would like to see you upon some important business. Please come at your earliest convenience. Yours truly, Jose Pear, Secretary." The next morning I was alone with Monsignor Berger, who received me very kindly. He seemed at first to have entirely banished the bad feelings he had shown in our last interview at Quebec. After making some friendly remarks on my continual labors and success in the cause of temperance, he stopped for a moment and seemed embarrassed how to resume the conversation. At last he said, "Are you not the father confessor of Mrs. Chenier?" "Yes, my lord, I have been her confessor since I lived in Longueuil." "Very well, very well," he rejoined. "I suppose that you know that her only child is a nun in the congregation convent." "Yes, my lord, I know it," I replied. "Could you not induce Mrs. Chenier to become a nun also?" asked the bishop. "I never thought of that, my lord," I answered, "and I do not see why I should advise her to exchange her beautiful cottage, washed by the fresh and pure waters of the St. Lawrence, where she looks so happy and cheerful, for the gloomy walls of the nunnery. But she is still young and beautiful. She may be deceived by temptations when she is there, in that beautiful house, surrounded by all the enjoyments of her fortune," replied the bishop. "I understand, your lordship. Yes, Mrs. Chenier has the reputation of being rich. Though I know nothing of her fortune, she has kept well the charms and freshness of her youth. However, I think that the best remedy against the temptations you seem to dread so much for her is to advise her to marry a good Christian husband. A good Christian husband seems to me a much better remedy against the dangers to which your lordship alludes than the cheerless walls of a nunnery." "You speak just like a Protestant," rejoined the bishop, with an evident nervous irritation. "We remark that, though you hear the confessions of a great number of young ladies, there is not a single one of them who has ever become a nun. You seem to ignore that the vows of chastity is the shortest way to a life of holiness in this world and the happiness in the next." "I am sorry to differ from your lordship in that matter," I replied, "but I cannot help it. The remedy you have found against sin is quite modern. The old remedy offered by our God himself is very different and much better, I think. It is not good that the man should be alone. I will make an helpmeet for him," Genesis 2:18, said our Creator, "in the earthly paradise. Nevertheless, to avoid fornication, let every man have his own wife, and let every woman have her own husband," 1 Corinthians 7:2, said the same God through his Apostle Paul. "I know too well how the great majority of nuns keep their vows of chastity to believe that the modern remedy against the temptations you mention is an improvement on the old one found and given by our God," I answered. With an angry look, the bishop replied, "This is Protestantism, Mr. Chenecky. This is sheer Protestantism." "I respectfully ask your pardon for differing from your lordship. This is not Protestantism. It is simply and absolutely the pure word of God. But my Lord God knows that it is my sincere desire, as it is my interest and my duty, to do all in my power to deserve your esteem. I do not want to vex nor disobey you. Please give me a good reason why I should advise Mrs. Chenier to enter a monastery, and I will comply with your request the very first time she comes to confess." Resuming his most admirable manner, the bishop answered me, "My first reason is the spiritual good which she would receive from her vows of perpetual chastity and poverty in a nunnery. The second reason is that the lady is rich and we are in need of money. We would soon possess her whole fortune. for her only child is already in the Congregation convent. My dear bishop, I replied, you already know what I think of your first reason. After having investigated that fact from the lips of the nuns themselves, as well as from the father confessors, I am fully convinced that the real virtue of purity is much better kept in the homes of our Christian mothers, married sisters, and female friends than in the secret rooms, not to say prisons, where the poor nuns are enchained by the heavy fetters assumed by their vows, which the great majority curse when they cannot break them. And for the second reason, your lordship gave me to induce Mrs. Chenier becoming a nun, I am again sorry to say that I cannot conscientiously accept it. I have not consecrated myself to the priesthood to deprive respectable families of their legal inheritance in order to enrich myself or anybody else. I know she has poor relations who need her fortune after her death. Do you pretend to say that your bishop is a thief? Angrily rejoined the bishop. No, my lord, by no means. No doubt from your high standpoint of view, your lordship may see things in a very different respect from what I see them, in the low position I occupy in the church. But as your lordship is bound to follow the dictates of his own conscience in everything, I also feel obliged to give heed to the voice of mine. This painful conversation had already lasted too long. I rose up to take leave of him and said, My lord, I beg your pardon for disappointing your lordship. He coldly answered me, It is not the first time, though I would it were the last, that you show such a want of respect and submission to the will of your superiors. But, as I feel it is a conscientious affair on your part, I have no ill will against you, and I am happy to tell you that I entertain for you all my past esteem. The only favor I ask from you just now is that this conversation may be kept secret. I answered, It is still more to my interest than yours to keep this unfortunate affair a secret between us. I hope that neither your lordship nor the great God, who alone has heard us, will ever make it an imperious duty for me to mention it. What good news do you bring me from the bishop's palace? Asked my venerable friend Mr. Brassard, when I returned late in the afternoon. I would have very spicy, though unpalatable news to give you, had not the bishop asked me to keep what has been said between us a secret. Mr. Brassard laughed outright at my answer and replied, A secret? A secret? But it is a gazette secret, for the bishop has bothered me as well as many others with that matter frequently. Since your return from Illinois, several times he has asked us to persuade you to advise your devoted penitent, Mrs. Chenier, to become a nun. I knew he invited you to his palace yesterday for that object. The eyes and heart of our poor bishop, continued Mr. Brassard, are too firmly fixed on the fortune of that lady. Hence his zeal about the salvation of her soul through the monastic life. In vain I tried to dissuade the bishop from speaking to you on that subject, on account of your prejudices against our good nuns. He would not listen to me. No doubt you have realized my worst anticipations. You have, with your usual stubbornness, refused to yield to his demands. I fear you have added to his bad feelings and consummated your disgrace. What a deceitful man that bishop is, I answered indignantly. He has given me to understand that this was a most sacred secret between him and me, when I see by the what you say that it is nothing else but a farcical secret, known by the hundreds who have heard of it. But please, my dear Mr. Brissard, tell me, is it not a burning shame that our nunneries are changed into real traps to steal, cheat, and ruin so many unsuspecting families? I have no words to express my disgust and indignation when I see that all those great demonstrations and eloquent tirades about the perfection and holiness of the nuns on the part of our spiritual rulers are nothing else in reality than a veil to conceal their stealing operations. Do you not feel that those poor nuns are the victims of the most stupendous system of swindling the world has ever seen? I know that there are some honorable exceptions. For instance, the nunnery you have founded here is an exception. You have not built it to enrich yourself, as you have spent your last cent in its erection. But you and I are only simpletons. You have till now ignored the terrible secrets which put that machine of the nunneries and monkeries into motion. I am more than ever disgusted and terrified, not only by the unspeakable corruptions, but also by the stupendous system of swindling, which is their foundation stone. In the cities of Quebec and Montreal, could I know what I know of the incalculable sums of money secretly stolen through the confessional to aid our bishops in building the famous cathedrals and splendid palaces, or to cover themselves with robes of silk, satin, silver, and gold, to live more luxurious than the pashas of Turkey? They would set fire to all those palatial buildings. They would hang the confessors who have thrown the poor nuns into those dungeons under the pretext of saving their souls, when the real motive was to lay hands on their inheritance and raise their colossal fortunes. The bishop has opened before me a most deplorable and shameful page of the history of our church. It makes me understand many facts which were a mystery till today. Now, I understand the terrible wrath of the English people in the days of old, and the French people more recently, when they so violently wrenched from the hands of the clergy the enormous wealth they had accumulated during the Dark Ages. I have condemned those great nations till now, but today I absolve them. I am sure that those men, though blind and cruel in their vengeance, were the ministers of the justice of God. The God of heaven could not, forever, tolerate a sacrilegious system of swindling, as I know now to be in operation from one end to the other, not only of Canada, but of the whole world, under the mask of religion. I know that the bishop and his flatterers will hate and persecute me for my stern opposition to his rapacity, but I do feel happy and proud of his hatred. The God of truth and justice, the God of the gospel, will be on my side when they attack me. I do not fear them. Let them come. That bishop surely did not know me when he thought that I would consent to be the instrument of his hypocrisy, and that under the false pretext of a delusive perfection, I would throw that lady into a dungeon for her life, that he might become rich with her inheritance. Mr. Brissard answered me, I cannot blame you for your disobeying the bishop in this instance. I foretold him what has occurred, but I knew what you think of the nuns, though I do not go so far as you in that I cannot absolutely shut my eyes to the facts which stare us in the face. Those monkish communities have in every age been the principal cause of the calamities which have befallen the church. For their love of riches, their pride and laziness, with their other scandals, have always been the same. Had I been able to foresee what has occurred inside the walls of the nunnery I built here, I never would have erected it. However, now that I have built it, it is as the child of my old age. I feel bound to support it to the end. This idea does not prevent me from being afflicted when I see the facility which our poor nuns yield, in which our poor nuns yield to the criminal desires of their two weak confessors. Who could have thought that that lean, ugly superior of the Oblates, Father Allard, could have fallen in love with his young nuns? Have you heard how the young men of our village, indignant at his spending the greater part of the night with the nuns, have whipped him when he was crossing the bridge not long before his leaving Longueville for Africa? It is evident that our bishop multiplies too fast those religious abuses. My fear is that they will sooner than we expect bring upon our Church of Canada the same cataclysms which have so often desolated her in England, France, Germany, and even in Italy. The clock struck 12 just when this last sentence fell from the lips of Mr. Brissard. It was quite time to take some rest. When leaving me for his sleeping room, he said, "My dear Tinnicky, gird your loins well, sharpen your sword for the impending conflict. My fear is that the bishop and his advisers will never forget your wrenching from their hands the booty they were coveting so long. They will never forgive the spirit of independence with which you have rebuked them. In fact, the conflict is already begun. May God protect you against the open blows and the secret machinations they have in store for you." I answered him, "I do not fear them. I put my trust in God. It is for His honor I am fighting and suffering. He will surely protect me from those sacrilegious traitors in souls."